Hi, I'm Phil Davidson, and with me is Rockford Symphony Orchestra Music Director Stephen Larson. And we are discussing the RSO's April 2021 Chamber Concert, which is on the ComEd Digital Stage. And it's featuring the works of Randall Davidson. Now, there is a good name. Claude Debussy and Edward Elgar, I believe I pronounced that right. So looking first at Randall Davidson, I believe that he honed his composition skills at the University of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. A Cornell undergraduate moved to Minneapolis to study composition with Dominic Argento and other people up there, very well-known composing faculty, and spent the rest of his life there, still is living there. It's become a very, very important, very well-known part of the music scene in Minneapolis. And some people may know him as being a composer for Garrison Keillor. Wrote some pieces for Garrison Keillor's long-running radio program, including the Young Lutheran's Guide for the Orchestra to the Orchestra, which we have performed with the Rockford Symphony.
And I read that he's quite an advocate for composers. How so?
Yeah, he's been active in the Minnesota Composers Forum, which became the American Composers Forum. Actually, I think he was one of the founding members there. He's president of the American Music Center. Minneapolis, for many years, and I think probably still is, has been really a hotbed for young composers who really have their own kind of an ethos up there, their own style. They're not academically oriented. They write music for purposes and to try to engage people. And he's been a very important part of that movement.
Could you describe the character of his music and how it's often used?
Well, he describes his music as either being about humor or passion. And I think that that's probably pretty good. There's nothing abstract, nothing intellectual about what he writes. He's looking for an emotional connection of some sort. And that's generally what he does. The Young Lutheran's Guide is a great example of humor, and as is, frankly, the Mexico Bolivar Tango that we're going to be performing on this.
Did I read that he helped create four, I believe it was Nike, Grand Opera commercials?
Yeah, in the early 90s, he got a Gold Lion Award from the Cannes Festival in France for his work in this. And I remember these commercials vaguely. I didn't know that he did them at the time. And I've since tried to locate them to see what they are. I can't find them online anywhere, so maybe they'll pop up somewhere, but I'm still looking.
So you mentioned that you will be performing the Mexico Bolivar Tango. So give us a little more insight into this piece and the kinds of things we'll hear.
I first ran across this title, years ago when I was looking for pieces, going through catalogs of orchestral music. The title grabbed me because, Mexico Bolivar Tango, there is obviously a South American connection here with the tango, with Bolivar, Bolivia perhaps, but Mexico and tango, they don't go together. What in the world is this all about? And I finally asked somebody who knew him and knew the story about this. He said, there are two cities in Missouri, two small towns in Missouri, that are actually a fairly short distance apart, connected by the same road. And so it was part of a string trio that he wrote, the second movement of three movements for a string trio called Around Columbia, Columbia being, of course, a city in Missouri. And these, it's the the first part of it is a very typical sounding tango in C minor, which then morphs into a, well, it's still a tango, but it's got a very definite country and western feel to it. And back and forth. It's a really fun little piece of music.
Sounds really great. Well, then we move on to the 20th century French composer Claude Debussy. And he is described as one of the most prominent figures in Impressionist music. Did it not take him some time to achieve that prominence?
Yes, but you described him as a great 20th century French composer, which of course he is. But he was also a great 19th century French composer. He straddled the two centuries, and his first work, first major work that brought him to international notoriety, if not fame, was this particular piece, and which was premiered in 1894. He's called an impressionist composer, a term that he hated. He was very much familiar with the impressionist movement in art, and very much a consumer of impressionist artwork and impressionist poetry. But he really disliked the term as it was applied to his music, but it stuck. And today we know, basically, if you study music history, if you're asked to name the two, and there are really only two well-known composers of French impressionist music, you have Claude Debussy and Maurice Ravel.
Well, now, how would you describe impressionist music?
I think you could probably let's go back to impressionism in art, because that's where it all got started. It's about a decade or so before Debussy got involved in music and borrowing some of these techniques. Artists like Degas, Renoir, Manet, Monet, Cézanne, and the American Mary Cassatt indulged in a kind of a technical technical means of painting, but also sort of an ethical or ethos, whereas they were trying to present ordinary things, but ordinary subjects with a great emphasis on light and the impression that it made on you, the impression of the light. They would use very, very tiny brush strokes, but were still visible in the painting. They no attempt in the older style to hide the brush strokes, so it ended up looking like a kind of a photograph. No, the brush strokes, the texture, are very much a part of the composition. And the object of Impressionism wasn't so much to portray a realistic depiction, but to portray a kind of a feeling of the of that subject with the light at hand, emphasizing texture, emphasizing shadings of color. Now, Debussy came of age in an era where the 800-pound gorilla in music was Richard Wagner. And his ideas of music drama and the use of harmony and melody, the leitmotifs to tell stories, and the sort of bringing to a climax, into this highest form, the great traditions of German art music. Everybody in Europe, and particularly in France, in the 1870s, 1880s, were really struggling with this. Do you follow this? Do you follow his lead on this? Or do you try to find something else? And he wanted to find another path, another way. And one of the ways he did this was really by rejecting the bombast of German music, but also taking elements of music, for instance, harmony, which in the German tradition was very much very much part of a direction. Every chord had to move to another chord, to a particular, all in service of coming to the final cadence, which would bring the tonality to a finish. Debussy was quite remarkable in his early works, particularly in the prelude that we're going to play, in writing music where the harmony was just there to contemplate, to hear, to think about its beauty, its pungentness, its the fact that it wasn't going to go anywhere, it wasn't going to lead anywhere. It was just there to be heard, to listen to. This got him a lot of notoriety, and it also got him a lot of controversy. People obviously didn't like this. One contemporary said that to call the Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun a work of art, musical art, is like saying that a painter's palette is the final product. So he was saying that Debussy was not really creating a work of art. He was showing us, letting us hear his musical palette rather than composing something. Now, history has proven this person wrong. It's not only one of the most famous, most often performed pieces of music in the world, but one of the most often studied and analyzed and talked about.
Well, you know, I love Debussy's observation while he was working on La Mer. He said, and I quote, "The sea behaves with British politeness." Exactly what does that mean?
You know, I have no idea, because you got me on this one. I never heard that one before. And it certainly doesn't comport with Debussy's experience with the sea, because I think he only had one or two experiences on sea voyages, and they were not pleasant. They were very, very stormy, and he was not very fond of the experience. So British politeness, I'm not really sure.
I just found that very interesting.
But the subject of this piece, one interesting misconception of this piece has to do with the fact that we are English speakers. And the title, Prelude to, and the name of the it's the name of a poem, The Afternoon of a Faun. Now, Prelude, l'après-midi d'une faune in French. The translation of faun, F-O-U-N-E, in English is faun, F-O-U-N, which sounds unfortunately identical to F-A-W-N. And there have been a lot of people who have listened to this piece rapturously, thinking about the baby deers that they're hearing. No, nothing to do with baby deer. A faun is a satyr, half man, half goat, Roman mythological figure. This is a prelude on or after a poem by Mallarmé by that title. And it's a famous Impressionist poem, not known terribly well in English, because part of the attraction that Debussy had to the poem was the sound of the French, not necessarily the meaning of the words, but the way that the words sounded, which is, again, the Impressionist aspect. Not the meaning, but the visceral, you know, how you first hear the words and what pictures you conjure up in your mind after hearing these sounds. It's a little bit like there's a piece by Maurice Ravel, a famous piece called in English, Pavane for a Dead Princess, which sounds sort of morbid. But in French, it's Pavane pour une enfant défunte, an infanta, which is a Spanish princess, defunct, dead. But not necessarily, not the idea that the princess is dead so much, but the sound of those two words together was an interesting combination that inspired him to write this piece. And I always cringe whenever I see it in a program, the pavane for a dead princess. It's so morbid and so completely unrelated to the music.
I think you answered this, but I'm going to ask you again. Why is this piece considered a turning point in the history of music? I think you've already mentioned that, but
yeah, it was a turn away. It showed the French composers, the French artistic world, that there was a way forward, that you could write music that was French, that was intrinsically French, without paying homage to the German composers, the style of the German composers. You could use harmony in your own way. You could use melody in your own way. You could use whole tone scales, which completely negated the idea of tonality. You could set chords on their own, fairly dissonant chords, major seventh chords, 13th chords, and things like that. Chords with four, five, six notes in the harmony, and let them stand by themselves and not resolve them. Just let people listen to them. In a way, he's a little bit like Mozart in some respects, that in spite of the fact that he was so revolutionary, he was so difficult to imitate, though. You could take little parts of his technique, little parts of the coloristic writing and use them. As far as founding a school of composition, which he would have hated, he didn't do that.
Well, when we graduated from high school or we graduated from college, we most likely experienced the music of Edward Elgar, who created Pomp and Circumstance marches.
Five of them.
Yes. And I believe he actually began, rather than as a composer, he began as a performer.
Yes, yeah, he was a violinist. He played bassoon quite well, played piano and organ creditably. He was a professional violinist in a lot of respects, but he was also a very exalted amateur at heart. He, you know, his father was a professional musician. But he spent a good part of his early career teaching and working in a music shop, and composing and trying to establish himself as a composer. He wanted to go to Leipzig and study, but his family didn't have the money to send him there. So probably thankfully he didn't go. I mean, it's good for us he didn't go, because he was able to stay home and develop his own style, which, you know, he's, think about the English, the poor English, their history of composers. They had Henry Purcell in the 17th and 18th century, and then they had George Friedrich Handel, the German composer, who they adopted as their own. And until the late 19th century, they didn't have a significant composer, English composer, to call their own, until Elgar came along.
What was his breakthrough work?
The work we're going to hear. The variations on an original theme, also most often called the Enigma variations.
What? Any idea why did he use Enigma in the name of this piece?
This is one of the fun things about this piece is that people have been trying to solve the Enigma since its composition in 1899. He wrote about the fact that there was an enigma here. In the score, he wrote enigma and over the music of the first of the theme at the beginning. On a very superficial level, each one of the movements of each one of the variations has a somewhat enigmatic title. Initials, a nickname. something like that, which in themselves might be enigmas, except that he was very forthcoming about what those initials stood for, in most cases anyway, who they represented. And they were a tribute to his friends and to, significantly, to his wife, in music. And, he said that he got the inspiration one day. He came home from work and was, sitting and relaxing and doodling at the piano and improvising a little bit. And he played a couple of notes and put them together and played them again. And he said to his wife, Caroline, called from the kitchen and said, "What is that you're playing?" And he said, "I don't know, but I think it might become something." And he took those notes, that doodling, put them together to make the theme for this, and then built the rest of the piece, all of 14 variations, on, in his words, "To My Friends Pictured Within."
How would you describe the music?
Well, I'll read the quote here for the first performance. "I have sketched a set of variations on an original theme. The variations have amused me because I've labeled them with the nicknames of my particular friends. That is to say, I've written the variations, each one, to represent the mood of the party, the person, and have written what I thought they would have written if they were asses enough to compose." And the work was dedicated to my friends pictured within. There's a great deal of wit in these pieces, a great deal of inventiveness, genius, unbelievable genius. The more that I get into this piece, the more times I perform it, the more I am just awed by what a technically proficient and innovative and brilliant composer this man was. I just will tell you just a couple of the... The piece starts out in a very somber G minor with a very strange theme that always has a note of rest at the beginning of each bar. Rest. Da-da-dee-dum, da-dum, da-dum, da-da-dee-dum. So that's the theme. And you'll hear that appearing in every one of the variations, sometimes very obviously, sometimes very much under the texture, but it goes throughout the whole piece. The first variation is titled C-A-E, Carolyn Alice Elgar, his wife. And he incorporates, besides the theme, he incorporates a characteristic whistle that he used to announce his coming home with. Da-da-da-dum. He would whistle that as he was coming through the garden. And so that you hear that as kind of a counterpoint during this variation. There's a variation dedicated to a friend of his who was great at organizing other people. He would always just take charge and tell everybody where they were going to go, and just, "You're going to be in this room," and everything else. And he would finish by walking out and slamming the door. And you hear all of this in this particular, the fourth variation. William Meath Baker, country squire, gentleman, and scholar, forcefully informing his guests on travel arrangements, leaving the room and slamming the door. And one of my favorites is the movement Troit, which was dedicated to his friend's bulldog, who was a very well-known character apparently in the area, but had once during a walk had fallen down the banks of the River Wye and was furiously paddling upstream to find some place to get out. And when he finally did get out, announced it with a joyous bark at the end. And the dog's owner, George Robertson Sinclair, said to Elgar, "Put that in music, set that to music." And Elgar said, "I did." And the final movement, EDU, which is not a set of initials, but a play on his nickname, which is Edu, is a bit of a tribute to himself, but also includes a fair amount of his a tribute to his wife in there. It's a glorious, glorious movement. It's everything that is just, everything that the pomp and circumstance of British music of the end of the 19th century, the Victorian Edwardian era, everything that at its best. Of course, the most famous movement is the ninth movement, Nimrod. One of the most beautiful and just emotionally inspiring pieces of music ever written. In tribute to Elgar's best friend, who was an avid hunter and fisherman, and so he was given the nickname Nimrod, the biblical hunter. This piece, somber but in a major key, is requisite funeral music in Great Britain, often played at funerals of significant people. I don't know if it was done recently at Prince Philip's funeral, but I would be surprised if it wasn't. This is a piece that very few people can get through without tearing up a little.
Well, I tell you, this sounds like a really exciting and varied program with those three composers.
Yeah. I tell you, it's one of the things about this, of course, we haven't really talked about this, but we have, in order to accommodate distancing on the stage, we have only room for about 17, 19 musicians spread out over the Coronado stage. That means finding works that are interesting to perform, but still use a reduced number of players. Debussy, The Prelude in the Afternoon of a Faun, was written for a fairly large orchestra, except one that didn't have trumpets and trombones. And the Elgar Enigma Variations were written for a very, very large orchestra. So both of these had to be edited down to a string quintet and winds and brass. So it was a bit of a challenge to do that. I didn't do that. Two other arrangers have done that. But we're going to be presenting these pieces in a format that's going to sound, you'll recognize the tunes perhaps, but it's going to sound a little bit different, a little bit more delicate. And it's a challenge to do this. We're enjoying the process, but we're all hoping for the day that we can get the whole orchestra back on stage.
Absolutely.
There is one more thing that we forgot to talk about, is what is the Enigma? Because Elgar said that there is the theme which goes on constantly is never heard. And this has led to a cottage industry of conjecture and people trying to solve what the mystery is. What is the enigma? What is the unheard theme? He took the secret to his grave and nobody ever knows. Although I'd encourage listeners to go to Wikipedia, read the article and some of the possible solutions. I don't have a definitive idea myself, but my favorite is taken from a quote of his, that the theme never, never appears. And never, never. Where have we heard that before? Well, in Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves, and Britons never, never. Da, 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 da. That That is an ongoing motive that goes through this piece. And I don't know whether that's true or not, but I like to think it is. And finally, at the end, the glorious finale ending, when the brass intone that majestic theme, you feel the glory of Great Britain at its, the empire on which the sun never sets, at the height of its influence, the height of its power, 1900.
You may have solved the mystery.
No, I probably didn't, but I like it.
Sounds good to me. I accept it. So the April 2021 chamber concert video will be on rockfordsymphony.com, and it is free to the public. But at this point, the release date is unknown due to the fact of some of the things that Steve mentioned, that it is being professionally produced and edited, which, of course, RSO has never really experienced before. However, the release date will be announced through email and through social media, so you will know when it's available. But if you have any questions, you have any other information you would like about RSO, call them at 815-965-0049, or, of course, go to rockfordsymphony.com. And thank you for watching.
Goodbye, and stay healthy, be careful, and I can't wait to see you all back in the theater.